Tanta T. "You just wait a while," said my grandmother. "Don't go there now." "Fighting who?" Tanta T looked worried. "I did not ask," said my grandmother. "They hurt anybody?" "The coal man, Dessalines."
"Dessalines? Why?"
"When people hate you, they beat your animals. I don't know. Old woman, I am going to get a remedy for a lump in my calf, and it cannot wait."
Tante walked down the road, racing towards the marketplace.
"You have a lump on your calf?" asked my grandmother.
By then, Tanta T was already gone. My grandmother and I spent the day watching the beans boil. The kite boy wandered into the yard with a slingshot. He aimed his pebbles at a few small birds lodged in the cha-cha tree. He had no successes, but kept trying, encouraged by an occasional cheer from my grandmother and me.
"Eliab, come get some water," my grandmother called out.
Eliab walked to the porch where my grandmother kept a clay jug full of water. He soaked his stomach as he raised the jug to his lips. The beans were cooked as the sun set. My grandmother mixed them with some maize, which we ate with chunks of avocado. Tanta T did not come home for supper. My grandmother put some food aside for her and left the rest in the pot. I bathed Brigitte in a large pan that my grandmother dug out from under her bed, then gave her some formula before sitting down for supper. I felt both fat and guilty after eating my supper. Eliab and two other boys walked to the porch for some tin plates and spooned out their portions of the meal. They sat in a circle and ate quietly, like a clan of midget chiefs. Brigitte tried to bring her left foot to her mouth in order to suck her toes.
"She's a quiet child,"
my grandmother said. "She's been like that since she was born."
"Crabs don't make papayas. Your mother, she was a quiet child too."
Brigitte reached over to grab my grandmother's nose.
"Your husband?" asked my grandmother. "Why did you leave him so suddenly?"
"I did not leave him for good," I said. "This is just a short vacation."
"Are you having trouble with your marital duties?"
"Yes," I answered honestly.
"What is it?"
"They say it is what is most important to a man."
"The night?"
"Oui."
"You cannot perform?"
she asked.
"You have trouble with the night? There must be some fulfillment. You have the child."
"It is very painful for me," I said. She pulled her pouch from her pocket, pinched a few dabs of tobacco, and stuffed them in her nostrils.
"Secrets remain secret, only if we keep our silence," she said. "Your husband, is he a good man?"
"He is a very good man. I have no desire. I feel like it is an evil thing to do."
"Your mother, did she ever test you?"
"You can call it that."
"That is what we have always called it."
"I call it humiliation," I said. "I hate my body. I am ashamed to show it to anybody, including my husband. Sometimes I feel like I should be off somewhere by myself. That is why I am here."
"Creak," called my grandmother.
"Croak,"
answered the boys. Their voices rang like a chorus, aiding my grandmother's entry into her tale.
"Tim Tim,"
she called.
"Bois shesh,"
they answered.
"Tell master, tell us your tale."
"The tale is not a tale, unless I tell.
Let the words bring wings to our feet." "How many do you bring us tonight?"
"Tonight, only one story."
The night grew silent under her commanding tone. I lay on the bed with Brigitte, the open window allowing us a clear view of the sky. The stars fell as though the glue that held them together had come loose. They were not the stars you could wish upon. In La Nouvelle Dame Marie, each time a star fell out of the sky, it meant that somebody would die.
The story goes, said my grandmother, that a lark saw a little girl, who he thought was the most beautiful little girl he had ever seen, from the top of his pomegranate tree.
She clapped her hands to the rhythm of the words.
Not a lark. He wanted more than anything to have the little girl. So one day she was on the road going to school. The lark stopped her and said to her, "How would you like a nice sweet pomegranate, you pretty little girl?" When she looked up at the tree, the girl was charmed by the lark. So handsome it was, with its red and green wings and long purple tail. It was a sight. And a pomegranate, it was a beauty too, big as your head it was. The girl thought she could eat for weeks and not be done eating that pomegranate. So she told the bird, "Yes, I would like to have that pomegranate." The bird, it said, "I will give it to you for the honor of just looking at your face." Every day it went like this. The girl got a pomegranate, and the bird, it looked at her face. One day, the bird, it said, "I will give you 2 pomegranates if only you would kiss me." The girl thought of how sweet the pomegranates were, and how everyone was nice to her at school for her sharing the food with them. So that one day, she kissed the bird, and from then on always got 2 pomegranates. This went on for a while, until one day the bird, it said, "Would you like to go to a faraway land with me? You are so sweet and lovely. I would like to take you to a faraway land." The girl, she said, "I don't know if I want to go away." The bird, it says, "We will go by sea." The girl was afraid. She said, "I do not want to leave my family, my village." The girl, she says, "It is wet in the sea. You can go on my back." That is what the bird says. The girl, she said, "I will not go." The bird, it got mad. It said, "I am good enough to talk to. I am good enough to kiss. You eat my pomegranates, yet you will not go with me across the sea." Oh, the bird looked so sad. It looked like it was going to die of sadness. So the girl, she gave in to the bird and let him have his way. She said, "I will go." As soon as the little girl got on the bird's back, the bird said to the girl, "I didn't tell you this because it was a small thing, but in the land I am taking you to, there is a king there who will die if he does not have a little girl's heart." The girl, she said, "I didn't tell you this because it was a small thing, but little girls, they leave their hearts at home when they walk outside. Hearts are so precious. They don't want to lose them." The bird, clever as it was, it said to the girl, "You might want to return to your home and pick up your heart. It is a small matter, but you may need it." So the girl, she said, "Okay, let us go back and get my heart." The bird took her home and put her down on the ground. He told her he would wait for her to come back with her heart. The girl ran and ran all the way to her family village, and never did she come back to the bird. If you see a handsome lark in a tree, you had better know that he is waiting for a very pretty little girl who will never come back to him. The boys cheered and applauded the pretty little girl's cleverness.
"Is your story true?" they cried in unison.
"As true as this old woman's hair is blue," answered my grandmother.
They pleaded for another story, but she told them to go home before the werewolf on the sugarcane cart came out. The one who could smell you from miles away and would come and kill you unless you ran in a rage through the fields and hollered a list of all his crimes. Tontatie's feet pounded the porch a few minutes later.
"Would you read me something?" asked my grandmother.
"I am empty, old woman," she said. "As empty as a dry calabash."
Chapter 19. Tontatie was very cheerful as she stood in my doorway the next morning.
"Did you sleep all right?" she asked.
She was wearing her I Love New York t-shirt, this time with a long white skirt. Her hair was brushed back and tied in a tiny bun, resting like a porcupine on the back of her neck.
"Are you going somewhere?" I asked.
"Atie speaks to city folks today," she said. "Louise asked me to go with her, to have her name put on the archives as having lived in this valley."
My grandmother crept up behind her, gently brushing a broom across the cement.
"What's the use her getting registered?"
asked my grandmother.
"She is leaving soon, no?"
"Her name can be on some piece of paper for future generations," said Tontatie. "If people come and they want to know, they will know she lived here."
"People don't need their names on a piece of paper for that," said my grandmother.
"I will list my name too," Tontatie said.
"If a woman is worth remembering," said my grandmother, "there is no need to have her name carved in letters."
Louise hollered Tontatie's name from the road.
"That child has lungs like mountain echoes," said my grandmother. "You have lungs like mountains echoes," she shouted from the house.
Tontatie rushed out to the porch. My grandmother followed closely behind her. I watched through the window while Brigitte moved her head in all directions, trying to figure out what all the commotion was about. Louise was standing in the middle of the road, waiting for Tontatie. She had on a crisp lavender dress with a butterfly collar.
"Atie, you come now,"
she shouted, ignoring stares from the men on their way to the fields.
"Atie, can't the girl walk up to the house?" asked my grandmother. "We're not a spectacle. You tell her to come to the house. She's frightening the leaves off the trees."
Tontatie motioned for Louise to come. Louise dashed across the road and entered the yard. I walked out on the porch with Brigitte. Louise ran up to play with her.
"I remember you,"
Louise said, grimacing. Brigitte pursed her lips, trying to copy Louise's facial expressions. The broom fibers whistled as my grandmother furiously raked them in the dust.
"If a person is worth remembering,"
mumbled my grandmother,
"people will remember. It need not be cast in stone."
"We should go," Atie said, taking Louise's arm.
My grandmother went on with her sweeping as Tontatie and Louise rushed down the road. My grandmother walked around the yard, collecting sticks and dry leaves. I let her hold Brigitte while I walked across the road to throw some of Brigitte's used diapers over the cliff. Later, I took my camera out of my suitcase and took a few pictures of my grandmother holding Brigitte.
"They do scare me, those things," she said. "The light in and out. The whole thing is suspect. Seems you can trap somebody's soul in there."
I took a few more shots.
"Now, how many is that?"
she asked.
"Are you afraid that your grandmother will blend into thin air?"
"I want Brigitte to know you when she gets older," I said. "I want her to know how much of each of us is in her."
"Do you suppose she will have any recollection of today?"
asked my grandmother. "You can ask her yourself in a few years."
"If I live so long," she said. "Now go on and put your daughter down. Let her rest a bit."
I took Brigitte inside and laid her down for a nap. While she slept, I looked through my wallet for some pictures that I had brought with me. There was one of Brigitte, all shriveled up, a few hours after she was born. I almost refused to let Joseph take pictures of me with her. I was too ashamed of the stitches on my stomach and the flabs of fat all over my body. I looked at a small picture of Joseph's and my wedding. The two of us were standing before a justice of the peace a month after we had eloped. I had spent 2 days in the hospital in Providence, and 4 weeks with stitches between my legs. Joseph could never understand why I had done something so horrible to myself. I could not explain to him that it was like breaking manacles, an act of freedom. Even though it occurred weeks later, our wedding night was painful. It was like the tearing all over again. The ache and soreness had still not disappeared. Joseph asked me several times if I really wanted to go through with it. He probably would have understood if I had said no. However, I felt it was my duty as a wife, something I owed to him, now that he was the only person in the world watching over me. The first very painful time gave us the child. When Brigitte and I woke up, I took her to the old rocker on the porch. Eliab was flying a kite in the yard. There were a few other colorful kites in the sky, but his was the closest to the ground. He shuffled around a lot, trying to maintain his balance and keep the kite in the air. He slowly released the thread, allowing his kite to venture closer to the clouds. Another kite swooped down like a vulture. There were pieces of glass and broken razors on the other kite's tail. One of the razors slashed his thread and sent Eliab's kite drifting aimlessly into the breeze. The kite drifted further and further out of sight. Finally, it dived down and disappeared, crashing like a lost parachute at an unknown distance. Eliab reined in his thread. He pulled it with all his might, tying it around the stick as it came to him. The thread suddenly seemed endless. He got tired of coiling, dropped the stick, broke down and cried. Chapter 20. Louise came home for supper that night. She brought with her a furless gray pig that looked like a wild rat. My grandmother was cooking in the yard, her fried dumplings sizzling as she turned them over in the pan.
"I brought you one of my pigs," Louise said, holding the animal towards me. "This is one of my smaller ones, a recent born."
"Merci mille fois," I said. "How very nice."
"It's a gift, not for money," she said.
Brigitte reached up to grab the pig's brown eyes. Louise quickly pulled the pig away from my daughter's wandering fingers.
"Merci," I said. "Thank you very much. Are you listed in the town record book now?"
"Listed for certain," she said. "Attie listed herself and your grandmother too."
Louise gently stroked the pig's back, letting his tail dart across her chin.
"They had this for us at the Post and Telegram Bureau."
Tante T pulled an International Express letter out of her satchel. The letter bore my mother's Nostrand Avenue address.
"Old woman, where's the cassette machine?" shouted Tante T.
My grandmother pointed to her room. Tante T rushed inside and came back with their cassette player. She laid it on the steps and ripped open the envelope. My grandmother walked over and sat on the bottom step. She kept her eyes on the clouding sky as my mother's voice came through the small speakers.
"Allô, maman? Attie? Good morning or good night if it's morning or night. I hope your health is good. Me? You know how it goes. I am swimming with the current. At least I'm not in a mental hospital. I hope you got the money I sent last month, maman. No, I haven't forgotten that little extra you asked me to send, so you can plan your funeral. In any case, there is no hurry.
Mama, you are still a young woman. Speaking of young people, I don't want you to trouble your spirits, but I received a telephone call from Sophie's husband not too long ago, telling me that he was on some sort of musical tour. He left Sophie at home with their child, and it happens he keeps calling Sophie at their house and she's not there. He's very uneasy. I wanted to stop the tape, but my grandmother was listening closely, her wrinkled forehead drawn into a knot. The pig squealed loudly, momentarily drowning out my mother's voice. My grandmother reached over and yanked the pig's tail. Louise pulled the pig away and buried its face in her chest. The pig whimpered and oinked even louder. Louise placed her hands over its snout and tried to drown out its bawl. The husband thought she might have come to spend the time with me. I am already having panic attacks about this. Could be she came to her senses, but not to return to me. I have already lit some candles for her. Green for life, like you've always said. I tapped the stop button with my toes. The pig began to wail more loudly, as though it suddenly felt it could. My grandmother got up and went back to her cooking.
Isn't it time you reconciled? Tante Ati said.
Chapter 21. Louise tied the pig to a pole in the yard. My grandmother fed it a pile of old avocado peels before we ate. How much money do you still need to pay for the trip? I asked Louise.
I made only 10 gourdes since the last time you saw me, she said.
Brigitte stretched out her hand to grab the fireflies buzzing around us. After the meal, we sat on the back porch and listened as Ati read from her notebook.
She speaks in silent voices, my love, like the cardinal bird kissing its own image. Li pale no voix moen, flapping wings, fallen change, broken bottles, whistling snakes and boom-bang drums. She speaks in silent voices, my love. I drink her blood with milk, and when the pleasure peaks, my love leaves.
Louise had helped her paraphrase the poem from a book of French poetry that Louise had read when she was still in school. You're a poet, too, I said to Tante Ati. She pressed her notebook against her chest. After her reading, she and Louise strolled into the night, like silhouettes on a picture postcard. My grandmother took the cassette player to her room to listen to the rest of my mother's message. I heard my mother's voice coming through the thin walls. I am not having the short breath anymore, but every so often I do find myself dreaming the bad dreams. I thought it would end, but lately it seems to be beginning all over again. Brigitte was still awake, even after my grandmother fell asleep. I wrapped her in a thick blanket, took her outside to show her the sky. Tante Ati was sitting on the steps, feeding the pig. Is it male or female? I asked.
What difference does it make to the pig?
She asked. I want to give it a name.
Call it Paul or Paulette, Jean or Jean. The pig will not protest. You do not have to name something to make it any more yours.
Are you in a sour mood?
My life, it is nothing, she said.
What's the matter? Do you miss Croix des Roses?
Croix des Roses was painful. Here, though, there is nothing, nothing at all. The sky seems empty even when I am looking at the moon and stars.
There were drums throbbing in the distance. Some staccato conch shells answered the call. I wish I had never left you, I said.
You did not leave me. You were summoned away. We must graze where we are tied.
I wish I had stayed with you.
You must not go back and rearrange your life. It is no use for what has already happened. Sometimes
There is nothing we can do. Do you want to go back to Croix de José? I asked.
I know old people. They have great knowledge. I have been taught never to contradict our elders. I am the oldest child. My place is here. I am supposed to march at the head of the old woman's coffin. I am supposed to lead her funeral procession. But even if lightning should strike me now, I will say this. I am tired. I woke up one morning, and I was old myself.
She threw a small green mango at the pig.
They train you to find a husband, she said. They poke at your panties in the middle of the night to see if you are still whole. They listen when you pee to find out if you're peeing too loud. If you pee loud, it means you've got big spaces between your legs. They make you burn your fingers learning to cook. Then, still, you have nothing.
The pig jerked forward. The cord tightened around its neck, nearly causing it to choke. Tontati rushed over and loosened the rope.
Take your baby inside, she said. I know you have heard them, the frightening stories of the night.
The pig oinked all night. Tontati woke up several times to check on it. My grandmother got up to see what all the commotion was about.
That Louise causes trouble.
My grandmother turned her wrath to Tontati.
Everything from her shadow to that piggy's trouble.
Don't trouble me tonight, old woman.
Tontati strained to control her voice. The pig started a slow nasal whine.
I will kill it, said my grandmother. I will kill it.
My daughter woke up with a sharp cry. I fed her and rocked her back to sleep. The pig, it was still crying, but there was nothing I could do. Louise was out of breath when she ran up to the house the next morning. Her face was reddened with tears and her blouse soaked with sweat. My grandmother motioned for me to take the baby inside the house. I backed myself into the doorway while clinging tightly to my daughter. I watched from the threshold as Tontati gave Louise a cup of cold water from the jug beneath the porch.
Li, allez. It's over, Louise said, panting as though she had both asthma and the hiccups at the same time. They killed Dessalines.
Who killed Dessalines? Asked my grandmother.
The Makout killed Dessalines.
Louise buried her head in Tontati's shoulder. Their faces were so close that their lips could meet if they both turned at the same time.
Calm down,
said Tontati as she massaged Louise's scalp.
That's why I need to go, sobbed Louise. I need to leave.
The poor man is dead, and all you can think about is your journey,
snapped my grandmother.
Next might be me or you with the Makout, said Louise.
We already had our turn, said my grandmother. Sophie, you keep the child behind the threshold. You are not to bring her out unless that restless spirit is in the ground.
In the fairy tales, the Tonton Makout was a bogeyman, a scarecrow with human flesh. He wore denim overalls and carried a cutlass and a knapsack made of straw. In his knapsack, he always had scraps of naughty children whom he dismembered to eat as snacks.
If you don't respect your elders, then the Tonton Makout will take you away.
Outside the fairy tales, they roamed the streets in broad daylight, parading their Uzi machine guns.
Who invented the Makout? The devil didn't do it, and God didn't do it.
Ordinary criminals walked naked in the night. They slicked their bodies with oil so they could slip through most fingers. But the Makout, they did not hide. When they entered a house, they asked to be fed, demanded the woman of the house, and forced her into her own bedroom. Then all you heard was screams until it was her daughter's turn. If a mother refused, they would make her sleep with her son and brother or even her own father. My father might have been a Makut. He was a stranger who, when my mother was 18 years old, grabbed her on her way back from school. He dragged her into the cane fields and pinned her down on the ground. He had a black bandana over his face, so she never saw anything but his hair, which was the color of eggplants. He kept pounding her until she was too stunned to make a sound. When he was done, he made her keep her face in the dirt, threatening to shoot her if she looked up. For months she was afraid that he would creep out of the night and kill her in her sleep. She was terrified that he would come and tear out the child growing inside her. At night, she tore her sheets and bit off pieces of her own flesh when she had nightmares. My grandmother sent her to a rich mulatto family in Croix de Rosé to do any work she could for free room and board as a restavec. Even though my mother was pregnant and half insane, the family took her in anyway, because my grandmother had cooked and cleaned in their house for years before she married my grandfather. My mother came back to La Nouvelle Dame Marie after I was born. She tried to kill herself several times when I was a baby. The nightmares were just too real. Tonta T took care of me. The rich mulatto family helped my mother apply for papers to get out of Haiti. It took 4 years before she got her visa, but by the time she began to recover her sanity, she left. Tonta T took me to Croix de Rosé so I could go to school, and when I left, she moved back here to La Nouvelle Dame Marie to take care of my grandmother. Somehow, Dessalines' death brought to mind all those frightening memories. That night, I opened the window to listen to the night breeze rustling through the dry cha-cha bean pods in the distance. Tante T was talking to Louise. Her voice was muffled, her breathing quickened, and she sobbed loudly.
"It is the calm and silent waters that drown you. I never thought it would make me so sad to look in Sophie's face."
The pig gave a sudden cry as Louise rushed away. Tonta T slipped inside the house through a side door.
"Nothing should have taken you out into that black night."
My grandmother was waiting inside.
"Did a bird nest in your hair? You seem to have lost your mind."
"Maybe a good death would save me from all this," Tonta T said.
I heard a thump, like a slap across the face. Tonta T stormed out of the house and marched out to the porch. When I came out, Tonta T was sitting with a lamp and her notebook on her lap. I folded the flaps of Joseph's shirt between my legs and sat on the top step next to her.
"Do you ever visit Mr. Augustin?" I asked.
"No," she said. "Sometimes people just disappear from our lives, and it is not a bad thing."
We sat silently and looked at the stars for a while. "I'm going to excuse myself and go back inside," I said. "I don't want to leave the baby alone for long."
"The old woman, she's going to send word to your mother that you are here," she said.
"My mother does not concern herself with where I am."
"You are judging her much too harshly."
"When Joseph and I first married, I used to write her every month. I've sent her pictures of Brigitte. She keeps the letters but makes no reply."
"She will come," said Tonta T.
"Come where?"
"She will come here. She has promised for a long time to come and arrange the old woman's funeral. And the old woman will place on the cassette words begging her to come, so you can settle this quarrel."
Brigitte got up early the next morning, ready to bounce and play. I lay her on the bed and tried to make her do some baby exercises. In the next room, my grandmother was recording her reply cassette to my mother.
"Martine Kijonier,
how are you?"
We are doing fine here, following in the shadow of Father Time. I am well, except for the old bones that take some time. Dessalines has died. Makut kill him. Do you remember him? He was the coal man. I don't even need to talk about Ati. She is carrying on like she has got a pound of rocks on her chest. Sadness is now her way of life. You needn't worry about Sophie. Could be she is on a little holiday. The bird, it always returns to the nest.
My grandmother stopped to clear her throat. Brigitte grabbed my fingers and held them tightly as she rolled on her side.
Is that tea in her room?
Yelled my grandmother. She's out, I shouted back. Brigitte shrieked, trying to scream along.
Is there something you want to say to your mother?
No. The recorder clicked to a stop.
Any more you want to say?
Asked my grandmother. I think we've already said enough. In the distance, the bells tolled, announcing Dessalines' funeral. Pontati stumbled into her room, her body rocking from side to side. She lowered herself to the ground, her large feet barely sidestepping my outstretched leg and Brigitte's toes. Tontati's eyes were red. She blinked quickly, trying to keep them open. She snapped her fingers and made faces at Brigitte to get her attention. Are you all right? I asked her.
Fine, good.
Her breath smelled like rum. She stretched her body out on the floor and within a few seconds fell asleep. She woke up at noon with a panic-stricken look in her eyes.
My notebook, she asked. You seen it?
I shook my head no. Brigitte was asleep on the bed. I was afraid that Tontati's sudden movements would wake her up.
Maybe the book's in my room,
she mumbled, heading for the door. Were you drinking? I asked.
I drink a little to forget my troubles, she said. It's no more a vice than the old woman and her tobacco.
She walked out to the yard, splashed some water over her face, then started towards the road. She came back in the very early morning hours. The voices in the yard kept me awake.
You can go now, said Tontati. Let me see you enter, insisted Louise. That calf of yours. Go and rest that calf of yours. People do not die from aching calves, said Tontati. You think I am an old lady. I do not need a walking cane. Be pleasant, Tati. Go inside.
I heard Tontati walk inside. The bed squealed under her body as she crashed on it. Louise walked home alone in the fading dusk. Chapter 22. The next morning, a pack of rainbow butterflies hovered around the porch. I was sitting on the steps, watching the sun rise behind the shack's spotted hills. My grandmother's face was powdered with ashes as she left the house. She lowered a black veil over her face as she twirled a rosary between her fingers. The baby let out a sudden cry from Tontati's room. I rushed back in. Tontati was pacing as she carried her around the room. Brigitte stretched out her hands when she saw me. She pressed her face down on my neck when I held her against my body.
Did the old woman leave for the cemetery? Tontati asked.
Is that where she is going?
She is going to pay your last respects to Dessalines.
Brigitte clawed my neck with her fingernails. You and Louise, you're very close, aren't you? I asked Tontati.
When you have a good friend, she said, you must hold her with both hands.
It'll be hard for you when she leaves, won't it?
I will miss her like my own skin.
My grandmother had her veil on her arm as she walked back towards the house. Eliab ran to her and took a heavy bundle from her hand. He pulled out its contents, sniffing the coconuts before setting them down. Did you have a nice visit to the cemetery? I asked.
There are two ways to go to the cemetery. One is on your 2 feet. The other is in a box. Each way, it is a large travail. Where is your Tante Tati?
She's visiting with Louise.
Why do I even ask?
She picked up a machete from under the porch and chopped a green coconut in half. Eliab pushed an open gourd beneath the coconut and caught the cloudy liquid flowing out of it. My grandmother carved out the flesh with a spoon and stuffed it in her mouth. She chopped another coconut and brought it over to me. The coconut milk spilled all over my chest as I raised the shell to my lips. My daughter reached out to grab the coconut. My grandmother and Eliab sat on an old tree stump, sharing the soft mush inside the coconut. My grandmother threw some at the pig, which it leaped up to swallow. Tante T did not come home for supper. My grandmother and I ate in the yard, while Brigitte slept in a blanket in my arms. My grandmother was watching a light move between two distant points on the hill.
Do you see that light moving yonder?
She asked, pointing to the traveling lantern.
Do you know why it goes to and fro like that?
She was concentrating on the shift, her pupils traveling with each movement.
It is a baby,
she said.
A baby is being born. The midwife is taking trips from the shack to the yard where the pot is boiling. Soon we will know whether it is a boy or a girl.
How will we know that?
If it is a boy, the light will stay on. If there is a man, he will stay awake all night with the new child.
What if it is a girl?
If it is a girl, the midwife will cut the child's cord and go home. The mother will be left in the darkness to hold her daughter. There will be no lamps, no candles, no more light.
We waited. The light went out in the house about an hour later. By that time, my grandmother had dozed off. Another little girl had come into the world. Chapter 23. A rooster crowed at the next morning's dawn. I peeked into Tante T's room. Her bed was still made without a wrinkle on it. She had not come home at all the night before. My grandmother had made herself some bitter black coffee with a lump of salt to prepare her body for the shock of bad news. I sat out on the porch with Brigitte, waiting for the food vendors to come by. They trickled by slowly, each chanting the names and praises of their merchandise. My grandmother bought some bananas, boiled eggs, and hard biscuits. Louise and Tante T came up the road. Tante T was ahead. Louise marched a few feet behind her. My grandmother looked up without acknowledging their presence. Louise walked into the yard, charged towards the tree, untied her pig, picked it up and walked away. Why? What are you doing? I called after her. She did not turn back. What's the matter with her? I asked Tante T.
Mama told her to come get the pig, or she will kill it,
Tante T said. Tante T was carrying a small jar of water with three leeches inside. Is it true, Grand-mère? Did you say that? I asked.
We need a pig. We buy a pig,
said my grandmother. I will buy it, I said.
No, no, Tante T jumped quickly. The money, it will surely go for her boat trip to Miami. You think you can keep money out of her hands?
Asked my grandmother.
I do not want to push her into the ocean, Tante T said.
She raised the leech jar towards the sun. The animals squirmed away from the light, their black slippery bodies coiling into small balls. She raised her skirt and stretched out her calf. Opening the jar, she tipped it over so that the water was soaking her skin. The leeches slowly crawled out of the jar and climbed on a lump on her calf. She ground her teeth when one of the larger leeches bit into her skin. She leaned back against the porch railing, pulled her notebook from her sack, and began writing her name. She wrote it over and over, following a pattern at the top of the page. The leeches sucked the blood out of her lump until they were plump and full. She pulled them away one by one, slid her fingers down their backs, and pumped the blood into an empty jar. I felt my head spinning, my stomach about to turn inside out. Tonta T noticed the pained expression on my face.
"It's no loss, Angel," she said. "It's only blood, bad blood at that."
I asked my grandmother if I could cook supper for us that night. Tonta T offered to take me to a private vendor where food was cheaper than the mashie. She put the leeches in some clean water and we started down the road.
"What are you making for us?" she asked.
"Rice, black beans, and herring sauce," I said.
"Your mother's favorite meal."
"That's what we cooked most often." We followed a footpath off the road, down to a shallow stream. An old mule was yanking water vines from the edge of the stream, while baby crabs freely dashed around its nostrils. A woman filled a calabash a few feet from where my sandals muddied the water. Tonta T chatted with the women as she went by. Some young girls were sitting bare-chested in the water, the sun casting darker shadows into their faces. Their hands squirted blackened suds as they pounded their clothes with water rocks. A dusty footpath led us to a tree-lined cemetery at the top of the hill. Tonta T walked between the wooden crosses, collecting the bamboo skeletons of fallen kites. She stepped around the plots where empty jars, conch shells, and marbles served as grave markers.
"Walk straight," said Tonta T. "You are in the presence of family."
She walked around to each plot and called out the names of all those who had been buried there. There was my great-grandmother, beloved Martinelle Brigitte, her sister, my first joy, Sophie Luce Gentil, my grandfather's sister, my hope, Atinia Ife, and finally my grandfather, Charlemagne Le Grand Cacou. Tonta T named them all on sight.
"Our family name, Cacou, is the name of a scarlet bird. A bird so crimson it makes the reddest hibiscus or the brightest flame trees seem white. The Cacou bird, when it dies, there is always a rush of blood that rises to its neck and the wings. They look so bright, you would think them on fire."
From the cemetery, we took a narrow footpath to the vendor's hut. On either side of us were wild grasses that hissed as though they were full of snakes. We walked to a whitewashed shack where a young woman sold rice and black beans from the same sisal mat where she slept with her husband. In the yard, the husband sat under the shade of a straw parasol with a pipe in his mouth and a demijohn at his feet. He was pounding small nails into leather straps and thin layers of polished wood to make sandals. The hammering echoed in my head until I reached the cane fields. The men were singing about a woman who flew without her skin at night, and when she came back home, she found her skin peppered and could not put it back on. Her husband had done it to teach her a lesson. He ended up killing her. I was surprised how fast it came back. The memory of how everything came together to make a great meal. The fragrance of the spices guided my fingers the way no instructions or measurements could.
Our men, they insist that their women are virgins and have their 10 fingers.
According to Tonta T, each finger had a purpose. It was the way she had been taught to prepare herself to become a woman. Mothering, boiling, loving, baking, nursing, frying, healing, washing, ironing, scrubbing. It wasn't her fault, she said. Her 10 fingers had been named for her even before she was born. Sometimes She even wished she had 6 fingers on each hand, so she could have 2 left for herself. I rushed back and forth between the iron pots in the yard. The air smelled like spices that I'd not cooked with since I'd left my mother's home 2 years before. I usually ate random concoctions, frozen dinners, samples from global cookbooks, food that was easy to put together and brought me no pain, no memories of a past that at times was cherished and at others despised. By the time we ate, the air was pregnant with rain. Thunder groaned in the starless sky, while the lanterns flickered in the hills.
"Well done," Tontati said after her 4th serving of my rice and beans.
My grandmother chewed slowly, and she gave my daughter her bottle.
"If the wood is well carved," said my grandmother, "it teaches us about the carpenter. Ati, you taught Sophie well."
Tontati was taken off guard by my grandmother's compliment. She kissed me on the forehead before taking the dishes to the yard to wash. Then she went into the house, took her notebook, and left for her lesson with Louise. My grandmother groaned her disapproval. She pulled a small pouch and packed pinches of tobacco powder into her nose. She inhaled deeply, stuffing more and more into her nostrils. She had a look of deep concern on her face as her eyes surveyed the evening clouds.
"Tendez, do you hear anything?" she asked.
There was nothing but the usual night sounds, birds finding their ways in the dark as they shuffled through the leaves. Often at night, there were women who traveled long distances on foot or on mare to save the carfare to Port-au-Prince. I strained my eyes to see beyond the tree shadows on the road.
"There is a girl going home," my grandmother said. "You cannot see her. She is far away. Quite far. It is not the distance that is important. If I hear a girl from far away, there is an emotion, something that calls to my soul. If your soul is linked with someone, somehow you can always feel when something is happening to them."
"Is it Tontati, the girl on the road?"
"No, it is really a girl, a younger woman."
"Is the girl in danger?"
"That's why you listen. You should hear young feet crushing wet leaves. Her feet make a swish swash when they hit the ground. And when she hurries, it sounds like a whip chasing a mule."
I listened closely, but heard no whip.
"When it is dark, all men are black," she said. "There is no way to know anything unless you apply your ears. When you listen, it's come see you had deafness before, and you can hear now. Sometimes you can't fall asleep because the sound of someone crying keeps you awake. A whisper sounds like a roar to your ears. Your ears are witness to matters that do not concern you. And what is worse, you cannot forget. Now listen. Her feet make a swish sound, and when she hurries, it's like a whip in the wind."
I tried, but I heard no whip.
"It's the way old men cry," she said. "Grown brave men have a special way they cry when they are afraid."
She closed her eyes and lowered her head to concentrate.
"It is T. Alice," she said.
"Who is T. Alice?"
"The young child in the bushes, which is T. Alice. Someone is there with her."
"Is she in danger?" My grandmother tightened her eyelids.
"I know T. Alice," she said. "I know her mother."
"Why is she in the bushes?"
"She must be 14 or 15 years now."
"Why is she out there?"
"She is rushing back to her mother. She is with a friend, a boy.
I thought I heard a few hushed whispers. I think I hear a little, I said, rocking my daughter with excitement.
Tea, Alice and the boy, they are bidding one another goodbye for the night.
My grandmother wrapped her arms around her body, rocking and cradling herself. What's happening now? I asked.
Her mother is waiting for her at the door of their hut. She's pulling her inside to test her.
The word sent a chill through my body.
She's going to test to see if young Alice is still a virgin,
my grandmother said.
The mother, she will drag her inside the hut, take her last small finger, and put it inside her to see if it goes in. You said the other night that your mother tested you. That is what is now happening to tea, Alice.
I have heard it compared to a virginity cult, our mother's obsession with keeping us pure and chaste. My mother always listened to the echo of my urine in the toilet, for if it was too loud, it meant that I had been deflowered. I learned very early in life that virgins always took small steps when they walked. They never did acrobatic splits, never rode horses or bicycles. They always covered themselves well, and even if their lives depended on it, never parted with their panties. The story goes that there was once an extremely rich man who married a poor black girl. He had chosen her out of hundreds of prettier girls because she was untouched. For the wedding night, he bought her the whitest sheets and nightgowns he could possibly find. For himself, he bought a can of thick goat milk in which he planned to sprinkle a drop of her hymen blood to drink. Then came their wedding night. The girl did not bleed. The man had his honor and reputation to defend. He could not face the town if he did not have a blood-spotted sheet to hang in his courtyard the next morning. He did the best he could to make her bleed, but no matter how hard he tried, the girl did not bleed. So he took a knife and cut her between her legs to get some blood to show. He got enough blood for her wedding gown and sheets, an unusual amount to impress the neighbors. The blood kept flowing like water out of the girl. It flowed so much it wouldn't stop. Finally, drained of all her blood, the girl died. Later, during her funeral procession, her blood-soaked sheets were paraded by her husband to show that she had been a virgin on her wedding night. At the grave site, her husband drank his blood-spotted goat milk and cried like a child. I closed my eyes upon the images of my mother slipping her hand under the sheets and poking her pinky at a void, hoping that it would go no further than the length of her fingernail. Like Tante T, she had told me stories while she was doing it, weaving elaborate tales to keep my mind off the finger, which I knew one day would slip into me and condemn me. I had learned to double while being tested. I would close my eyes and imagine all the pleasant things that I'd known. The lukewarm noon breeze through our bougainvillea, Tonta T's gentle voice blowing over a field of daffodils. There were many stories about our ancestors having doubled. It was said that most of our presidents had actually been split in two, part flesh and part shadow. That was the only way they could murder and rape so many people and still go home to play with their children and make love to their wives. After my marriage, whenever Joseph and I were together, I doubled. The testing. Why do the mothers do that? I asked my grandmother.
If a child dies, you do not die. But if your child is disgraced, you are disgraced. And people, they think daughters will be raised trash with no man in the house.
Did your mother do this to you?
from the time a girl begins to menstruate to the time you turn her over to her husband. The mother is responsible for her purity. If I give a soil daughter to her husband, he can shame my family, speak evil of me, even bring her back to me.
When you tested my mother and Aunt Ati, couldn't you tell that they hated it?
I had to keep them clean until they had husbands.
But they don't have husbands.
The burden was not mine alone.
I hated the tests, I said. It is the most horrible thing that ever happened to me. When my husband is with me now, it gives me such nightmares that I have to bite my tongue to do it again.
With patience, he goes away?
No, Grommy, Ife, it does not.
Tialis, she has passed her examination.
The sky reddened with a sudden flash of lightning.
Now you have a child of your own. You must know that everything a mother does, she does for her child's own good. You cannot always carry the pain. You must liberate yourself.
We walked to my room and put my daughter down to sleep. I will go soon, I told my grandmother. Back to my husband.
It is better, she said. It is hard for a woman to raise girls alone.
She walked into her room,